the Great Awakening, we had founded Hampton, Sydney, the College of New Jersey, as citadels of learning. We had had Mr. Davies, Samuel Davies, as a missionary to the southern colonies, the southern states, and there are many churches in North Carolina, where I come from, which still show the handiwork of Samuel Davies. They are still there. And his missionary endeavors were very fruitful in the southern Great Awakening. And those churches still bear the mark, the imprint of that very fruitful ministry. And so the century which was opening beckoned Presbyterianism. And the vista which lay before Presbyterianism was a tremendous vista. Not only did the Great West beckon us, but the East beckoned us. Theologically, we were ripe for development. People were calling for the ministry. And yet, even as seeds of decay were present in the national fiber, the national constitution, I'm not speaking of the document, I'm speaking of the nation. The insidious thinking of Thomas Jefferson and his cohort was present and was hardly able to be prevented from making its appearance felt. The virus of the French Revolution was entering the country. And ere long, as Dr. Packer intimated the other day so correctly, Kantianism would enter into the fabric of our thinking. Coming over with Edward Everett in 1819, the man who gave the very boring great address, a very boring address at Gettysburg, and who put the audience to sleep in no short time, was also a Kantian. As so was George Bancroft. They had been studying on fellowships in Germany. They came back and began to preach Kantianism. Ere long, Hegelianism would make its way into our thinking. Ere long, Transcendentalism would rear its ugly head to mar the theological and the philosophical and the social landscape of this country. And before long, New York would become the burnt over ground, with heresy abounding on every hand and with strange cults emerging around every corner. So that the 19th century, with all its potent for greatness, also held within it dangers for Presbyterianism. And I would labor on this lecture to you today, and perhaps not finish until tomorrow, for a very good reason. Because in the 19th century, we see what has come forth into full bloom in the 20th century. If you see a problem in Presbyterianism today, yea, if you find problems in evangelicalism today, those problems are present in the 19th century. Perhaps not as full grown. They didn't have television to propagate them. They didn't have the insidious press we had today to propagate them. But apart from that, they were there. And the soil was fertile enough for them. And so the century which promised so much and opportunity also promised, humanly speaking, disaster if we were not careful as a people, as a covenant people, as a church. And so I would entitle my lecture today, Theological Tensions of the 19th Century, for they abounded. But you know, I would add as a footnote, I think Dr. Packer intimated this, tension is good if properly controlled. A church that has no tension is not exploring the full depth of the gospel. A church which has no tension is not exploring all the ramifications of its faith. And so, when I speak of the word tension, I do not necessarily mean that as a criticism. There is fruitful tension. There is fruitful exploration. And I love Dr. Packer's quip about Luther and his oddity in regard to his conception of the book of James, or the epistle to James. And he didn't care, even if Melanchthon did not agree with him, and Melanchthon most certainly did not agree with him. But that did not mar their beautiful friendship, existing down until the day that Luther died, when Melanchthon burst out into tears and grief over the death of his friend, hardly able to stand it, because the tension for them was not one which in any way broke their Christian fellowship. And so tension within the church does not necessarily have to break Christian fellowship, even among scholars. I would hope that it didn't. You cannot expect a scholar always to agree. As a matter of fact, I wonder what I'm doing here with seminary professors or ordained pastors. And I'm an elder. I never went to seminary, and that's probably showing. And I don't feel like I belong in the big leagues, but here I am, so I may be a designated hitter. At least in the American League, if not in the National. Revivalism would enter the picture. Secession would enter the picture. Both in nation and in the church would enter the picture. Heresy would enter the picture. Revivalism, with its best aspects and with its worst aspects, would enter the picture. And a false reunion would enter the picture. Or as the century wore on. And as the century wore on, worse heresies would rear their heads. Darwinism, social Darwinism, higher criticism, communism would all enter into the American picture and would all affect the church. And to top it off, so would a false and very dangerous kind of ecumenical movement. All this is part of the 19th century. It's a fruitful, it's an interesting study, and obviously it's also a course which I can't give. Incidentally, I have an apology to make to you people. I phoned this morning Phillipsburg, New Jersey, the distribution office for one known as Charles Hayes Craig and the Presbyterian Reformed Publishing Company. I find out that he is waiting for me to complete my new edition with a new chapter to bring up the date of my theological interpretation. The girl at the desk informed me that they have a backlog of orders, and he didn't tell me this. I didn't know that I was holding him up. I had begged him to let me know what the status was of the ninth printing as to how many he had left. He didn't, and I assumed he had enough. He doesn't, and I will go home. I will get to work. I will finish the chapter as soon as I can. I will get it into Mr. Craig as soon as I can. I did not know this until today because I was getting curious as to what had happened and also somewhat bothered because they couldn't get any copies. So that's it. Now, I'm not trying to sell that book. As a matter of fact, there are none to sell. So I can get away with it and say that in part of that book, I treat in passing some of this. That book is not a history of Presbyterianism and not intended to be. But because of its theological dominance, its theological importance, I did treat certain aspects of the Presbyterian problem as illustrative of the problem in general. Now, to the work. You may not know this, but the century opened with a very great revival in the Presbyterian Church. It's not in the history textbook. It is in the histories of Presbyterianism, but in some of them it's rather toned down because it was so effective. But about the year 1795 to 1800, a great revival broke out at Hampton Sidney College in Virginia under the leadership, note of its president. I don't have time to read to you the tremendous quotes which show the nature of that revival. It was a thoroughly reformed revival. It was a disciplined revival. It was a pervasive revival. And it was a lasting revival. As a matter of fact, in some ways, it never died out. But it started with a student body, a student-faculty prayer meeting at Hampton Sidney College, and it spread to Kentucky. It spread to North Carolina. It spread all over Virginia, to South Carolina, and even to the hinterlands of Georgia. I hope there are not too many Georgians here. But my family, my brother lives there, my daughter lives there. But it did, and it wasn't the fly by night. It wasn't the tremendously emotional type in which they swooned and fell on the floor, because at the same time, in Kentucky And in Tennessee, they were having that type of revival. This was a, if I might use the word, a Calvinistic revival with great preaching, great response, condemnation of sin, regeneration, repentance, conversion, and all that goes with it. And it had a tremendous impact. It never really died out. The century opened on that beautifully bright note. So far as time is concerned, of continuity, it probably was the most continuous revival we've ever had in this country, outlasting the Great Awakening, and I pay it full credit. It was, in a sense, part of the awakening in the southern colonies, but it was more than that, because it came over into our national period under Dr. Smith of Hampton, Sydney. So with that opening, we go now to past introduction. The Christian church, and here I'm dealing with infiltration of non-Christian thought into Presbyterian theology and into evangelical theology in general. The Christian church must always be aware of the possible infiltration of anti-Christian thinking in its ranks. Dr. Packer beautifully brought out the tremendously harmful impact of Immanuel Kant. I was surprised that Dr. Packer didn't tell you the story, but you know the great story about Immanuel Kant was that as he walked around his garden at Königsberg, he was creating his philosophy, and he'd write it down in bits of paper, and every once in a while, one of those bits of paper would fall on the ground. He had a very faithful gardener who picked up these bits of paper and who compiled Kant's original philosophy. And, and the story went that that he understood it far better than the students, because he had the one original edition, and it slipped in the hands of Kant. And the conclusion of the story is this, that when that gardener died, the key to Kant died also. And nobody's had that key since. But perhaps because they didn't have a key, perhaps because they didn't understand Kant, Kant had a deadly effect on the thinking of Germany, on the thinking of England, and on the thinking in this country. Because he did come here. Contrary to what some historians would have us believe, the 19th century was vitally and intellectually alive. And American students did go to Germany before the war between the states. They even went in the first decade. And they brought back Kant, and very soon they brought back Hegel, for better or worse, and I would say for worse. And during the colonial period, the Presbyterians in the colonies, more than any other group, had withstood the ravaging infiltration of deism. Deism entered into the thinking of the Episcopal Church in Virginia, somewhat in North Carolina, but particularly in Virginia, Maryland, and in the northern colonies. And, of course, we know what happened to the remnants of Puritanism by the infiltration of deism, a very dangerous heresy. But it had not touched Presbyterianism. That was probably because the Presbyterianism was the stronghold of Scotch-Irish, and they were impregnable by such heresies. We note that the frontier was a potent force. It was a dangerous force. But combined with the implications of Kantian philosophy, this became the great danger, the great evil of facing Presbyterianism. And I want to emphasize this to you so much because at the very moment that these heresies or these philosophies were making their way into our country, the frontier was beckoning us. And you say, well, why could that be a danger? Presbyterianism, more than any other denominational system, demanded a trained ministry. It demanded a form of worship compatible with its theology, a form of discipline compatible with its theology. And don't ever forget that. And this proved to be a real problem, because as the people went west, we were not equipped to send out sufficient ministers. And so in 1801, we entered into a plan of missionary union with the Congregational Church of New England and the Middle States, particularly Connecticut and Massachusetts. And this proved to be a very serious problem. In essence, in a church started west of Pennsylvania, you could have a congregational congregation united in a congregational association, and they call a Presbyterian minister. Or you could have a Presbyterian church with a congregational minister. And that proved to be the more popular pattern because there were more congregational ministers available than there were Presbyterians. So many churches were formed and under Presbyterian auspices, yet they got congregational ministers at the very time when in congregationalism there was the infiltration of these very serious philosophical and theological heresies. And this plan of union put a tremendous pressure on the Presbyterian Church to lower its standards. At the same time, in western Pennsylvania, a movement which you may know as the Carmelite movement broke out. Also, a similar movement broke out in Bardstown, Kentucky, and in Tennessee, which ultimately resulted in 1810 in the foundation of the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. Now, this was a doctrinal problem as well as an ecclesiastical problem, because Alexander Carmel, the founder of the Christian or the Carmelite Church, was not Orthodox. I know his slogan, nothing but the Bible, but his Bible was deficient. He didn't accept the deity of Christ. He believed in baptismal regeneration, and he had serious questions in regard to the nature of the Trinity. So, the Christian Church, with its almost non-existent demands for a trained ministry, and the demands of the Cumberland Presbyterians in Tennessee and Kentucky for the lowering of the standard of the Westminster Confession, particularly Chapter 3 on election, produced an upheaval of tremendous heretical proportions. Now, the Cumberland Presbyterians were honest. They withdrew from the Presbyterian Church. The Carmelites created their own non-denominational denomination. Alexander Carmel did not believe in denominations. In spite of that, he established one of the largest ones in the country in a protest against denominations. Now, I'm not trying to be facetious, but this is true. But you see what was happening. At the same time, the Baptists, who had, of course, come in much earlier, but were beginning to feel their oats, so to speak, theologically and ecclesiastically, were beginning to gain great numbers and great strength. Just after the American War for Independence, Bishop Asbury came in and, of course, organized the Methodists. And they, with their democratic philosophy, and the Baptists, with their democratic church organization, proved to be the churches who met the needs of the frontier, at least on the surface. Because, obviously, the Methodist itinerant preacher and the Methodist lack of demand for trained ministry made it possible to ordain men to meet at least the most basic religious needs of the frontier people. At the same time, the Baptists lowered their orthodox stance in regard to the confession of faith, and with their democratic church organization, with every church an independent, more or less independent group, they could establish churches wherever anybody wanted them, without the permission of Presbytery and without the general requirement of the Presbyterian Church. So that, and I want you to be sympathetic, the Presbyterians of the East did face a problem. And I wouldn't deny it. The frontier was a problem in more ways than one. It was wild and willing, lawless, and in an effort to spark religious zeal, you have the great revival on the Kentucky frontier, which the Presbyterians promptly disowned. And I can tell you why. In Kentucky and Tennessee, they had what was known as religious frenzy. And in 1798 and 99, they had great camp meeting revivals, attended by as many as 7,000 and 10,000 and 15,000 people for a period of 2 or more weeks. And they would have 3 or 4 preachers all preaching at the same time in different circles. And people would faint and swoon As a matter of fact, one candid observer said he saw 2,500 people faint and swoon at a camp meeting. And the ministers would go on with the people writhing and going through gyrations in front of them and think nothing of it. And then they would sing hymns, and then they would have more preaching. Now, I would never say that people were not saved because the Holy Spirit does His work in the midst of very peculiar and difficult human conditions. And that's the sovereignty of God at work. But this type of worship was not fitting for the gospel. It did not ennoble the gospel. It was a travesty. But the frontier people, with their pent-up emotional and religious demands, ran wild. And the Presbyterian Church General Assembly took a very, very dim view of this procedure and suggested the Cumberland Church, Cumberland Presbyterian at that time, get ordained ministers who would behave according to the standards of the church. The Cumberland Presbyterians didn't want to do that, and so they organized their own Cumberland Presbytery in 1810, about the same time that the Carmelites organized their church. So the Presbyterian Church was losing its numerical prestige. This is the point I would make. At the same time they were facing these problems in regard to the frontier conditions, in the East, they were having another very serious problem. And I want to devote some attention to it because as you study it, I think you will find out that it is really one of the most serious developments in American political, social, and economic history. I am referring to Transcendentalism, which was the American form of Kantian Hegelianism and of the English Romantic movement. Now, you say, why do you bring that in a lecture on Presbyterianism? Because it made tremendous inroads on the thinking of the church. It was another method by which human secular philosophy weakens the message of the church by infiltrating. And it found an alliance with another very dangerous movement. I hope you understand why I say this. I don't want you to think I'm a communist, because I've never been noted for that. The frontier gave currency to a movement known as democracy. Now, I do not mean to imply that democracy had its origins on the frontier, but needless to say, the frontier gave a very interesting contour to the democratic movement. In the East, the old Lockean Jeffersonian philosophy was the philosophical root for democratic thinking, but it was rather subdued. I could never imagine Jefferson doing what the frontier democracy did. I'll tell you a story to illustrate what I mean. Whatever you may say about Jefferson, he was a man of simplicity. And when he was inaugurated, it was a very, very simple inauguration. In fact, for many people, it was entirely too simple. He didn't believe in spending money. He'd get somebody else to do it. And so he had a very, very, very simple inauguration. In contrast, Jackson, the man of the people, the man who represented the great democratic masses in 1828 and who was elected in that year over the very staid and extremely able John Quincy Adams, was inaugurated. On inauguration day, and this is true, his supporters and campaign managers took out from the White House the one bathtub which it had. They stopped it up, filled it full of whiskey, and got out of the rush, because after the inauguration celebration, Jackson's leadership made headlong dives into that bathtub head first, cracked each other's skulls, and drank the whiskey. And when it was empty, it was filled again. If you look in a very interesting newspaper called Niles Weekly Register, there's a vivid description by Hezekiah Niles, the editor, of that event. It's well worth reading to see what the triumph of the people meant. They swung from chandeliers in the White House, and they made the British look like pikers when they burnt the White House in 1812 or 1814. The British never did the White House what Jackson's people did to it. Now, I've mentioned that because by 1820 and 1830, this was coming to a focal point, and the Presbyterian Church, like the other churches, was facing a great danger. But Presbyterianism more so, because it was more geared to law and decency and order. Democracy, the frontier, Hegelianism, and Kantianism, and the Jeffersonian Lockean political philosophy were all converging to produce a great problem philosophically, politically, socially, and economically for the country. I don't have time to go into Kantianism. I was hoping that my learned colleague and friend would do that for me, but he didn't do much with it. He left the burden with me, but I cannot do it. I would point out that this new transcendentalism produced a new and more radical form of Unitarianism. As a matter of fact, it was so radical, as it was embodied in Ralph Waldo Emerson, that the old staid Unitarians of the church of which he was pastor suggested, in no uncertain terms, that he might want to find a new pastor. As a matter of fact, they strongly suggested that he leave the church, because they couldn't take his radicalism. Now, this might surprise you about Ralph Waldo Emerson. He's hailed in the literature as a great writer. He was a great writer. But you read what he wrote. It is thoroughly secular. It is certainly humanitarian. Let man stand alone, he said, which means let him stand alone. God, if there be one, please stand aside. Now, he didn't put it in that brutal form. He did it in beautiful English. He wrote that poem by Concord, Wonderful Bridge, you know. He was a great writer. I wouldn't deny that. But his writings are saturated with a new and radical form of Unitarian theology, which gained a great coverage in New England. He published, along with others, a little paper known as the Dial, which was intended to say that for Calvinism, time has run out. His friend Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., the poet and autocrat at the breakfast table, wrote a poem which you probably studied in high school when he used to teach great literature. If you were there, what they considered great literature, The One Horse Shay. How many of you ever read that poem? Do you know what it really means? It's a parody on the decline and collapse of Calvinism. Calvinism is the one horse shay. The wheels fall off, the top falls off, the horse dies, the shafts fall off, and the carriage falls apart. And he was writing about Calvinism. In the Dial, he and his colleagues poured out their vials of philosophical and theological wrath on the hapless head of Calvin. Now, obviously, Emerson's hopes that Presbyterianism would die and wither on the New England vine were doomed to failure. And their attacks, as I pointed out the other night, were against Presbyterianism. Because Emerson realized that from his point of view, from the transcendentalist point of view, from the Kantian point of view, from the Hegelian point of view, Calvin was the enemy. And to be sure, Presbyterianism did not long remain immune to the contagious nature of this terrible heresy. The democratic philosophy, transcendentalism, mingled with the beckoning call, the alluring call of a frontier type of life. And so what happened was the development of a new type of Arminianism. Within the fold, within the borders of the Presbyterian Church. Now, I do want to make a footnote here. Historians have long puzzled about this. They've wondered about it, and I must confess, I cannot exactly give you a dogmatic answer. I wouldn't try. But this new heresy of transcendentalism left the South unscathed. Now, you may be able to answer this. I've long thought about it, but this is the beginning of what we call the Bible Belt. The only Southerner to be subject to this contagion was Edgar Allan Poe. And he, of course, wandered all over the nation, so he was not really a Southerner, but he did live in Baltimore. But he sometimes is regarded as a Southern poet. But we have an answer. We had an answer in great literature from many, many people. I don't know the answer to this question. I've long pondered it. But the Southern Presbyterian Church and, at this time, the Episcopalian Church in the South and the Methodist Church in the South was virtually immune to this thing, as were the Southern Baptists. I do not know the answer. In the North, it was rampant. It produced Arminianism and Presbyterianism. It produced splits. And it produced the Seventh-day Adventist movement. It produced the Mormons. It produced about 100 different types of colonies, of communist experiments, communist experiments, and whatnot. It produced, well, you name it, it came in this era. All the various experiments. It also brought over Fanny Wright from Scotland, who tried to team up with Emerson, but she was for the ERA in its original form, and she practiced free love, and she annoyed Emerson, who did not believe in that kind of a social life, and he suggested that she go back to Scotland, whereupon Fanny Wright, who was quite loose with her tongue, said, "Why don't you take my place and go back yourself?" And that brought about a break in their relationship. Now, this Arminianism was a Presbyterian response to the democratic impulse of the democratic philosophy on the one hand and to transcendentalism on the other. It broke out in Philadelphia and New York. As a matter of fact, its leader at that time was a well-known minister by the name of Albert Barnes, who wrote copiously, and he did some good writing. But he was an Arminian. And I shall come back to that a minute later. But this movement did not only just affect the Presbyterian Church, it made tremendous inroads into the Congregational Church, which had been weakened by previous developments and was ready for the takeover. And it virtually enveloped the Congregational Church in eastern and central Massachusetts, in most of Connecticut, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Maine. And those Congregationalists who were seeking to escape this, incidentally, moved over into Upper Indiana, Upper Ohio, and into the northern section of Illinois, and it was they who founded Wheaton College. That's how Wheaton College was founded. So, well, I see the time is over. That was just an introduction to this lecture. It produced what we know as the New Haven School of Theology, and it also produced the Oberlin School of Theology, headed by Charles G. Finney. I shall have much more to say about Charles G. Finney, who was probably the most dangerous evangelist this country ever produced. I'm not unmindful of his modern counterpart. Oberlin became a hotbed of heresy. It became a hotbed of degeneracy, blasphemy, and finally, in this century, it became the pioneer college which opened its gates to communism. And this is easily proved. But he founded Oberlin School of Theology. This is a product of the Transcendental Movement. I see the time is over, so I shall close.